Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
7:13 now, 100% chance for showers today. It's going to rain on and off, hopefully not heavy, and the showers don't park in one area to cause any street flooding, but you do have to be aware of that. 40% chance for showers tomorrow, 30% on Mother's Day. Highs Monday of only 79, but get ready, because by Thursday, they're forecasting the first high temperature of 90 degrees for the year. And then from there, look out. Got a new pope. Pope Leo XIV, formerly known as Cardinal Prevost from Chicago, got some New Orleans roots as well. We'll talk about that in the 8 o'clock hour. But first, Michael Paskey joins us, an associate dean in LSU's College of Humanities and Social Services and a professor of religious studies and history. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Hey, great. Good morning to you.
Professor, I was talking yesterday with somebody, kidding around. I saw him interviewing the Pope's brother in Chicago, and I was saying, you know, it's a very powerful position, but yet, in terms of doing you a solid, he's not going to get you out of a traffic ticket, I don't think. So the Pope is a very powerful position, but how is it so, and where does he have power, and where does he not have power?
Yeah, look, so he's, you know, he's the boss of a church that has 1.4 billion people, but they don't report directly to him, mm-hmm. right? The Catholic Church is a global church. His power in many ways is kind of soft, right? He tries to speak the truth and convince Catholics and even non-Catholics to consider what he's saying and as a representative of the church. And he kind of goes from there. But that soft power, you know, historically, we've seen popes also play a role in a kind of geopolitical way, which arguably is a little bit more important than getting people out of a traffic ticket.
So when it comes to the job description of the Pope, and I'm not trying to be silly about this, I'm serious. What would you say if you're going to, it's an important job, right? So there's got to be a job description of the duties. What are the Pope's duties?
Yeah, I think you can split them into two. One, I think people would almost immediately think of, right? He's kind of he is the spiritual leader of this enormous global church, which means that he's going to kind of toe that line when it comes to the theology and the doctrines that the Catholic Church holds true. Which is pretty standard. It's what you would expect. Catholics would know this when they're listening to homilies or they're learning about the catechism or they're, just your standard. Yeah, that's religion. That's spirituality. But kind of behind the scenes, I mean, this is a massive organization, billions and billions of dollars in assets. It's a church not without controversy. We have the clerical sex abuse scandals over the last several decades. You have the selection of bishops to place throughout the world. There are all kinds of crises and controversies that come up. All the finances. They have a secretary of state within the Vatican that handles international affairs. So while it is a kind of spiritual role, there's also a very kind of practical, almost CEO type role. And it's that kind of balance that popes try to strike when it comes to the job that they have for the rest of their life.
One thing I think that did kind of get me to thinking yesterday is that as far as the attention that he gets when a new pope is named, you can be president for 4 years, for 8 years, then you go do something else. But part of the fascination, I think, with this is that when a guy is named pope, other than Benedict, or I think there was one previous pope that retired,
right. Yeah.
pretty much that's the rest of your life, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Pope Benedict was an exception, certainly a modern exception, which was kind of a big deal, you know. And it was kind of big of him to, you know, he was looking at himself and he was like, you know what, I can't do this anymore, because I care about my church and I want a new leader to carry it forward. But yeah, this Pope here, he's 69 years old, which is relatively young for a Pope. We, you know, barring any kind of ailments or surprises, he's got at least 10 years, maybe 20. It's possible he could go longer than John Paul II, which was the longest serving Pope in history.
Is he the first baby boomer Pope or not? I'm trying to get my ages straight here. Yeah. I know his father was a U.S. Navy veteran, as was mine.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I'm in the Navy Reserves, too. Yeah,
okay.
Props to your dad. He is the first boomer. That's going to be a fact, which is kind of interesting to think about someone who grew up in the second half of the 20th century. He is truly a modern Pope. He's a kid from Chicago who grew up there and was formed there, not just by the Catholic Church, which is a vibrant church in the Chicago area, but also, you know, American popular culture. There's already photos of him at the World Series in 2005 that are kind of popping up on the internet. We're going to get to know this Pope more than we ever have, we Americans, just because there's just so much out there, and he's an American. And so the interest, that's why we're talking now, is going to be pretty considerable.
When it comes to his heritage, we're going to talk later on about his roots in New Orleans being having some Creole roots. You know, I think when it comes to DNA, I'm no DNA expert on this, but we all descended from Africa one way or the other, right? That's where mankind developed, and so we all have African roots one way or the other. Does that factor in any of this at all?
So this is, I don't know who you're talking to. Maybe it's Jari Honoré. I'm not sure, at eight or whatever. So let's think about it this way.
That's exactly who we're talking to.
No, you're going to get it all from him. He is like a genealogical savant. He's amazing. That being said, let's think about this as just an American Catholic story. He's got grandparents who grew up and who came up out of New Orleans, which is obviously a very Catholic kind of place. Mm-hmm. And it's also a racially diverse place. So he's coming from that background genealogically, his family. His family story is a part of the Great Migration, with all of these people of color moving from the South into the North. And Chicago was a really important center of that migration. So his family is a part of that American story. And then he grows up a kid in Chicago as a baby boomer. And these two really important sort of Catholic centers in American life in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Says a lot about kind of just Catholicism in America generally. And it's kind of written into his profile, his story that now extends not just to the Vatican, but via Peru. I think this is an important point to make. He spent most of his priesthood in South America. He was a missionary. He was part of the Order of St. Augustine, the Augustinians. So he represents, obviously, the United States and that story, which is amazing, but also almost all of his adult life in Peru and in South America, and now he calls the Vatican home.
Let me take a break. I want to talk about the selection of his name and what we can read into that. Pope Leo the 14th. Pope Leo the 13th goes back to what year? Do you know, Michael?
1890s and early 1900s.
And it was a trick question, and you survived. You get to go into the lightning round when we come back, where dollar values are tripled. But no, seriously, I want to know about his name and what we can infer from that. 722 traffic now, WWL. 727 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Michael Pasquet, Associate Dean in LSU's College of Humanities, Social Sciences, Professor of Religious Studies and History. In case you missed the news, Habemus Papam. I just like to say that, Michael, so my time's running out to be able to say it, so I thought I'd get it in one more time. Let's talk about what we can infer from his selection of a name, Leo.
So Leo the 14th, he's at some point going to explain why he chose this name. So we're going to learn it from him at some point. But what we're thinking is that he is referring to the previous Leo, Leo the 13th, 1890s, early 1900s. He was an Italian. He is known for several things, but one most importantly, he wrote this encyclical, which is basically a pope writing something for the people to kind of teach them about important things related to Catholicism. And this particular encyclical it serves as the basis of Catholic social teaching as we know it today. And it argues for it, and it implores Catholics to consider the poor, the dispossessed, the marginalized, the working class, over and against exploitative forms of government, exploitative economic systems. And in that encyclical, it criticizes socialism as well as capitalism as systems of economies that can have negative impacts on the more vulnerable people in society. So that right there is signaling something to the effect that he may be inclined to follow in some of the footsteps of Pope Francis, who also took a more social justice orientation towards his papacy. But I would put one warning there. It is a kind of cheeky choice, because Pope Leo XIII also wrote several encyclicals that called on Catholics to return to a more traditional understanding of the church. He actually wrote another encyclical criticizing the bishops of the United States for being too American, for assimilating too much to American society and to modern society more generally. So in some ways, he's kind of striking a balance and maybe sending a more moderate message, not just to the College of Cardinals, but to all Catholics. But we're going to have to wait and see. We've got days, weeks, and months to actually get to know this person who's now Pope.
Professor, I'm going to be a minute late here, and news is going to have to bear with me, because I got to ask you this. You mentioned socialism, capitalism, Pope Leo the 13th. If Jesus were on Earth today, what would his economic philosophy be?
That's a big question.
It is.
It's a gotcha question.
Well, no, I'm just curious because he.
No. I'm being silly. I'm being silly. No, look, Jesus was not. Jesus would not be. He would be neither capitalist nor socialist. I mean, Jesus was. You know, go back to the Gospels. He was a pretty radical guy, and kind of led to a thing called a crucifixion because of these ideas.
But would it be communism? Because he said pool everything, right? And everybody.
It would be. It wouldn't be communism as we know it.
Okay.
It would be a kind of collectivism. You know, I'm being a professor now. I'm kind of.
You know what? You have to come back. We got to go to news, but you got to come back and spend some time with me on this, because I think it's an interesting question. Thank you, sir. 7:31. We'll talk to Mark Rose when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. 7:45, quarter to late, Friday morning around these parts. We help you manage your money with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. And if you can, I just want to remind you, if you can safely access jeffersonfinancial.org. Now, safely, I mean, not while you're driving or anything, because there's no obligation, no nothing. It's all absolutely free. You can go to jeffersonfinancial.org. You'll see calculators in the middle of the page. You click on that, it'll see some drop-down menus, almost 100 calculators you can use that'll help you manage your money. With that, we welcome in Mark Rosa. How you doing, Mark?
Good morning, sir, and happy Friday to you.
Happy Friday to you as well. What are we talking about today? What money are we managing?
Tommy, we had a couple of sessions ago, we had a little mention about real estate investment trusts, or REITs, as they're called. That's the acronym, REIT. And there's something that CEO of BlackRock, Larry Fink, had gone on Yahoo Finance recently and said, you know, it would be great if people would consider not the traditional stocks and bonds in their portfolio, but why don't they consider yet another asset class in infrastructure? And what if a lot of people pooled their money and said, well, let's buy a commercial building. Let's make sure the one that we want to buy is full of tenants. And the idea would be, as long as the tenants are paying the rent and can service the building with that money, there is an investment there. We can earn money off of that investment. And a couple of friends of mine who are local, and they have made their a good living off of commercial real estate. One is a commercial broker, and the other close friend of mine owns several pieces of commercial property. And he's expanded that over time. You buy one and you get the rents off of the tenants, and then maybe you have extra money to buy another one. Well, the alternative to that is, instead of looking for a bunch of friends to get together and pool a few million dollars to buy a potential strip mall or a large piece of commercial property, and you're looking at it from the rental revenue, what if there was an investment that you could do the same thing, but afford yourself a lot more liquidity? I know in the one friend's case, when he's ready to sell a building, well, you got to get it appraised. You got to, let's say, spruce it up if it needs anything. Let's get it prepared for sale. Then you finally put it out on the market and see what happens. Well, when he was talking to me about that, and he's done very well, and it's like, I can't get over the lack of liquidity. I would prefer more liquidity in my investment choices. What does that mean? That selling a commercial property might not be the fastest process somebody has ever experienced. I mean, it might take a couple of months. In theory, it might take a couple of years, depending on what's going on in the economy, what's going on in the property values. And it's like, that sounds good to get the rents and everything, but I could get them through a real estate investment trust. They are doing all the work for investors to say, we can pool money that are coming into the fund, and then we are buying one or many or hundreds of commercial properties. And then when those rents are being paid all across the country or wherever the geography is, then we pass along those earnings to the people that own the REITs. If you ever get tired of a stock or a bond, what do? You could press sell on your computer keyboard, and within 1 second, it's gone. Wall Street prides itself on the ability to get in and out of investments quickly. Not suggesting a trading environment, but if you're tired of looking at something, you could get out of it with not a lot of fanfare. And it offers just tremendous liquidity off of somebody saying, well, we bought a bunch of hospitals, and then we want to sell one or two of those, and how long would it take to turn that property over? So because of the construct of REITs, they've gone into a lot of areas of the economy around the infrastructure, and it's lodging, and it's retail, and it's industrial properties, and a lot of these self-storage units that people like to store a bunch of, stuff,
right?
And they pay the monthly rent. I was going to use some other words to describe it.
A lot, too, Mark. They pay a lot to store
they
that
do.
Stuff.
Well, it is. And I had one temporarily when I was moving from the South Shore to the North Shore for the reasons that they're used for. You put your stuff in and you get your property squared away, and then I didn't want to fall into the trap where I'm paying a perpetual rent to store stuff that's not worth the rent. And you get a lot of people that do that. And if you called around, it's not easy to find a unit that everything's rented up. Well, imagine owning the entire ULOC that you store it, or several of them, and you would get the rents off of that for people storing their stuff. Nothing wrong with that, but then you'd have the liquidity issue. You got to deal with all the maintenance and so on. So that, again, is where REITs come in. Any of our listeners are saying, well, I have a storage unit at ABC. Chances are there's a REIT behind that owns the property. They maintain it. More importantly to them, they collect the rents and share those rents with the unit holders or with the investors. So a lot of times, the dividends that they pay, well, let's start off. A bond pays a dividend typically twice a year. A stock will pay a dividend typically four times a year, quarterly. A REIT is collecting the rents on a monthly basis, so they pay the REIT holder, the investor, monthly. And a lot of people like that. You have these retirees that like certificates of deposits at banks because they can get their monthly income, and the REITs also. Well, REITs now are some of the REITs I was looking at this morning. They pay a 10% dividend, some as high as a 15% dividend. So the yields are very attractive, and it's not risk-free. You have to be concerned about or understand what you own, like any other investment. But if you're looking for that cash flow to come in, and many conservative investors, they want the dividend off of stocks. They're into bonds because of that, and they could be into REITs for the same reasons, but you get that more routine and more frequent cash flows. So it would be like investing in somebody's mortgage. They have REITs for that. They buy a bunch of mortgages. They buy a bunch of those investments around the country, and we can invest in them very easily. It's usually under a stock ticker, If you looked under Yahoo Finance and Google REITs, that would give you a lot of examples. And it's an easy in, easy out. But more importantly, it tends to be relatively conservative because of the properties they own. You pick the one that suits you. And it's like you have some stability there. Now, there's been instability with properties over time. There's been instability with any asset class. But you think about the commercial properties or the residentials or the U-Locket, U-Storitz, one we mentioned a minute ago. And it's, boy, they just sit there. They just sit there and collect the rent. And then they share it with, again, the stockholder. The REIT doesn't, they don't pay income tax. They pass along 90% of their earnings to the shareholders or the holders of the REIT. So it's that pass-through that, again, makes them very attractive. They're not paying tax on that. When you get the dividend, I mean, it could be in your IRA, could be in something where you don't have to pay tax on it right now, but the REIT holder would pay tax on the dividends that they get. But they can pass along more because they're not taxed on the earnings before it reaches the investor. So I had a couple of questions after we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, and I wanted to clear that up a little bit this morning, and hopefully I just did. But it's the types of properties they invest in. It's really grown because of those who want to get into that or find promise there, but they don't want to own the bill. I don't want to own an office building full of tenants. That's too much for me, but I can own it indirectly through a REIT investment.
Mark, one other thing that you touched on about the storage units, and I know a lot of people pay a lot of money for that.
They do.
For that. And when it comes to budgeting and so forth, that's something I think if you're going to conduct an audit of how much you spend a month, if you never look at this stuff and you don't even know what's in the storage unit anymore and you're still paying for it, maybe that's something you should consider doing away with.
Between that and gym memberships, I find that it gets pushed to the side. And if you're not using it, yeah, you could turn that loose. I had a close friend of mine told me to my face, I've had a storage unit for years. What I've paid on the storage unit is more money than the value of the contents. And he just kind of laughed it off. I said, okay, well, you're admitting it to me. Why don't you get rid of that stuff? It might be crap. And you don't have to pay the unit anymore. The storage unit would flip that unit over so fast because people are waiting in line to store their stuff in. But yeah, I mean,
I know people
it,
that pay a lot of money, hundreds of dollars a month to store stuff that they never ever look at. Thank you. 755 Real Information. Thank you, Mark Rosa. You can go to jeffersonfinancial.org, find those calculators. Mark will join us on Monday when he takes a look at the week ahead on Wall Street, Monday morning markets with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. 755, 5 till 8, traffic now, WWL.